He has a cast. It's very dirty. Welcome to Replaying Favorites. It's the movie podcast where two friends show each other their favorite films. And this week we are headed to the other side of the Berlin Wall when we watch 2017's Atomic Blonde, starring one Charlize Theron. I'm Brie Callahan.
I'm Chris Kelly.
And, well, this is the movie we're going to watch. Chris, what do you know about Atomic Blonde?
Other than the fact that Charlize is in it, literally nothing.
Okay. Well, James McAvoy is also in it. I don't think we've featured any James McAvoy in the show yet, have we?
He doesn't seem to have popped up in any of our previous films, but I do like him, so that adds to my excitement with this film.
It should. He's great. All right, well, this one's kind of a fun spy thriller, so I don't want to get too much into it now. I want you to uncover those things for yourself. So let's take it to the break, and we'll see you on the other side.
All right, I'm excited to watch it. We'll see you all in just a couple seconds.
Welcome back from the break. We have both watched 2017's Atomic Blonde. It stars Charlize Theron as Lorraine Broughton, James McAvoy, Eddie Marson, John Goodman, Toby Jones, Sofia Boutella, and Bill Sarsgaard. There are so many Sarsgaards out there in the world. It is the story of Lorraine, who is a British spy being interrogated by her home office after being sent to Berlin in the final days before the fall of the wall. She's there to retrieve the body of a murdered spy, to recover a list of agents, and hopefully to uncover a double agent named Satchel. She works with Percival, played by James McAvoy, Britain's man in Berlin, a shady dude who runs between East and West Berlin. Also on the ground are KGB agents and a new French spy, Delphine, played by Sofia Boutella. A whole bunch of double crosses and action sequences later, we learn that Percival has decided to sort of work for himself, offering to sell information about Satchel to the Russians in order to keep Berlin in a status quo. Lorraine kills him because he knows that she's Satchel, and she is revealed at the end as a triple agent, ultimately working for the CIA and John Goodman. I'm exhausted. Chris, what did you think of Atomic Blonde?
Brie, this one wasn't for me.
Oh, no. You know what? That doesn't surprise me at all. I realized that I texted you about, like, a scene of extreme mild violence at the beginning, and then it got incredibly more violent as time went on.
Weirdly, the violence is at the bottom of my list of critiques of this film.
Okay, well, what's at the top?
So, I would say the worst sin is that this movie is all style and no substance, and I don't care for the style.
Oh, see, I agree that it is all style and no substance, but I love this style.
What tanks it for me is that we are set in a very specific time and place, and that is spoken to us, God, just every scene. We can't stop reminding ourselves where we are and when we are, but we do need those reminders because nothing about how these characters dress or act grounds us in the time frame that we are supposedly in. Like, you and I have watched several movies from the late 80s on this podcast, and none of the clothes in this movie cropped up in any of those.
That's fair. I guess I would also say that I'm not an expert on what fashion was like in 1989 Germany, East Germany, or in Britain, so I can't really speak to that. But the movie definitely has an aesthetic of pink and blue neon, and that's a lot of it.
Yeah, there are two modes, and mode one is full neon. Mode two is, of course, the brutalist, desaturated, lots of harsh grays, with maybe a splash of red here and there. And you can see the graphic novel inspiration in that. You can see the comic frames on the screen for much of this, which I do appreciate as a style. But in general, for a movie that's all plot, the plot didn't matter a good goddamn.
It's funny that you say that you can see the frames of the graphic novel, and I should say that the author of The Coldest City, Anthony Johnson, does believe that this is a faithful adaptation of his book, but there are a few minor differences. For one, the book is a noir, and it's very serious, and it has almost no color at all. It's all a black and white book, and Lorraine has dark hair.
It's so funny that you bring up Lorraine's hair color, because on the one hand, you wouldn't think that that matters, but because Lorraine's only character trait is what color hair she has, like, we are meant to track her arc through her hair color because there's no other character, and I'll get into characterization or lack thereof as we move further into this discussion.
I do love that Americans are absolutely unable to conceptualize a blonde bad Russian. Like, as soon as you are a Russian agent, you must have the dark hair color in order to, like, fully pull it off. It's very silly. I guess maybe we might disagree on this. I was going to say, let's step back and talk about the fact that, like, the movie looks great. Like, Charlize looks great in this movie. And it is primarily running on the back of that.
Oh, no arguments about, in general, it being aesthetically pleasing. Had this been a 5-minute music video, I would have loved it.
Instead, it clocks in at almost 2 hours, arguably 20 or so minutes too long.
I believe I just asserted that all but 5 minutes are unnecessary.
Okay, so this isn't Better Off Dead level for you, but it was just not for you.
I wasn't repelled, but I wasn't actively entertained. It was passively nice, but it was essentially a screensaver.
Wow. It's sort of like two different movies to me. I agree with your point that Lorraine has almost no characterization. You don't really know what's happening behind her eyes. And I think part of that is by design, perhaps a clumsy design, because they need to keep from the audience that she has additional information, blah, blah, blah. And they do the same thing with Percival. However, I think James McAvoy as Percival brings a lot of fun and a lot of, I was going to say nuance, that's not necessarily what I mean. I think he brings a lot of charm to a character that could have played very, like, scuzzy. And he is scuzzy, but he's also a lot of fun when he's on screen.
My problem isn't with individual performances. The issue that this script has is that every character is a spy, literally all of them. And thus, no one is a real person. They are all a facade on a facade on a facade on a facade. And so they're all just chess pieces moving around the board. No one is human.
I realized as I was watching it today that I assigned you yet another dark, quasi-moody action thriller with unreliable narrators. Are we sensing a theme?
I have narrator problems as well that we will get into, but let's stick with one issue at a time. To get to your point about James McAvoy, I do think that he's doing his best to be dynamic and punchy and fun. But again, we're thrown the issue of the script overtly telling us that some of that is faked because it works for his spy persona. And, like, you know, that cast is fake because it has things in it and he seems like a loose cannon to throw you off guard. So all the things that are likable and fun and interesting about him are false.
I don't know that I agree with that. It's not like a hard disagree. I think Percival has a real interest in keeping Berlin the way that Berlin is because he's profiting off of it, sure, but he also likes it. Like, I think he likes the chaos. I think he probably feels tied down by whatever job he had at MI6 before this, right? Because we see that one shot of him in, like, a little tuxedo, and it's a very cute way to introduce him right before a smash cut into him, like, looking disgusting and, like, holding court in a bar in East Berlin. I think that this character has found himself in Berlin, and he's terrified that it's going to change because they know that everything's going to be different once the wall comes down.
Yeah, that is unfortunately a really weak character motivator for me. Like, it's not as though Percival has opened up a drag bar or started a DJ career or done something artistic that would actually keep Berlin weird. He wants a really oppressive political regime to remain, which I don't think is keeping Berlin weird. I think it's actually very bad and puts him desperately in the wrong. Like, keep the wall up is not a defensible position for an artist.
Okay, I want to be clear. I'm not on the side of the Stasi. I don't think that we are supposed to relate to him. So I don't think his intentions are good, but he does have more motivation than I think any of the rest of the characters do, including the guy whose death we see at the very beginning of the movie.
It's not that I think that James McAvoy's character is intended to be relatable. It's just that I literally don't think that his goal makes sense. I don't think that his endgame actually would, in any logical way, even to him, achieve the goal of keeping Berlin how it is. So it was a letdown to see that, like, I mean, not that by the time we got to that point, I expected there to be a smart plot in this film, but it was a letdown that his motivation was just pure garbage.
I have a note at some point that says, okay, so she gets that contact from the watchmaker, but it winds up using being Percival's contact in East Berlin, because that's the same kid that helped David escape to the... I shouldn't have questions about this movie still. I've seen this movie enough times to not have questions anymore. And it still takes so much work to work out like what all is happening. And that is just the sign of a movie that is too complicated for complicated's sake.
Yeah, none of it makes a lick of sense. The tone of everything is really serious. It takes itself incredibly seriously, but there's no need to, because it is high nonsense. I wish there had been more of a camp sensibility, as opposed to being like, well, what's the underpinning of all of these machinations between all these spies? It's like, just let them run around the city and fight in red heels. That's all I want.
I think there is some humor, and then it just kind of goes away, and you're right. Like, it very much thinks it's like a Bond movie, but without the sort of smirk that the Bond movies have a lot. It's very much like current Bond as opposed to old Bond. And I think they probably should have leaned into like that aesthetic a little bit harder.
Yeah, it's tough because we're supposed to believe that these are all the best spies in the world, but they all make a lot of incredibly dumb mistakes. There is no world in which a good spy gets into a car with strangers as soon as she gets off the plane. She knows that she has one contact to meet. She's going to meet that contact alone and not get into someone else's car, even if she thinks she could kill him with her shoe.
That's the problem with this movie having like a triple cross, which is that the KGB agents who pick her up should know that she is a Russian agent. All of that scene, even though it's very fun, is pointless because she's literally beating up her own guys. I don't understand why you would send, you know what, I'm not going to go on with that sentence because there's no point to it. It doesn't matter. This movie is about watching Charlize Theron beat dudes up and looking good while doing it. So like, we're going to talk about the plot, I'm sure, a little bit, but I spent more time looking at how the editing was done because it was actually really cool. Like, that's pretty much where this conversation is going.
My perfect metaphor for this film is in, there's one shot where Charlize is miking herself to go talk to I don't even remember who. And they zoom in on her taping the mic wire onto her fishnet stockings. And let me tell you, you can't tape something to a wide fishnet. That's just not physically possible. And it's really easy to run a wire underneath fishnet because it's just an open mesh. That would actually be much easier and more useful. But the movie is more concerned with showing you her putting down the tape. That's the whole movie. It doesn't matter whether it makes sense or if it would work. It's just fun to watch her do it.
Yeah. Yep. That's why I like this movie. What I was thinking about in the sort of 10 or 20 minutes before we were about to do this episode, I was just like, this podcast has exposed me as not real deep.
That's not true, because you're the only person who has ever brought contextual information to this podcast. You're the first person to be like, so the socio-political dynamics in the world at the time this was made, whereas I'm like, I don't know. It seems like she's pretty dumb. Like, I don't have any outside context.
Well, to that end, I definitely have a note at the very beginning that says, it is so much violence personally to me that this movie starts with Ronald Reagan. Also, that speech is from June 1987, not 1989.
I will say my first note is, we start with Reagan? Question mark. Just don't start anything with a picture of Ronald Reagan. That's not going to draw us in.
Yeah, I never want to see that dumb bastard again, to be perfectly honest. Anyway, while we're talking about style over substance, has there ever been a more useless character in a film than Delphine?
Yeah, it's tough because, as I've said, this movie has no humans in it. Delphine comes closest because since she's bad at being a spy, she's really open and honest and has human emotions. But it's very clear that she's there so we can watch her have sex with Charlize Theron in one of the wildest, worst sex scenes I've ever seen.
How can I put this? I don't think that's how it works.
No, I've, yeah,
Neither of us have had sex with a lady, so...
Yeah, I've never been a lesbian, but there's a long portion where Charlize Theron is humping her from behind, but there's no strap on. She's just dry humping
her butt.
There's no stimulation of any of the erogenous zones. Like, you as a human being know that someone rubbing their belly button on your anus doesn't do anything.
I sometimes want to come down on this movie for having just, I don't know, a lesbian exploitation sex scene. But it's also like, yeah, we should have that. Because if she and James McAvoy had wild, horrible sex, you'd just be like, hey, it's two hot people having sex. And so, like, there is something nice, I guess, about the movie just deciding, hey, here are two super hot people. Would you like to watch them have sex? And the answer is yes, but maybe not like that.
I do have a note from early in the movie about her and James McAvoy that just says, God, I hope they don't fuck.
And I'm so glad that they don't, because this movie teases it for a little bit, like it's going to happen. I will say also that the should it have been lesbians was definitely a choice, because in the graphic novel, Delphine's character is a man.
No, her character makes no sense, which is, I think, why their sex scene ends up feeling kind of exploitative, is that there's no redeeming qualities assigned to her character. She's terrible at her job objectively. She fucks up several times. Like, the movie goes out of its way to prove to you that she's just the tits.
And I think, like, if the movie had made the decision to make a sex scene between Theron and McAvoy, that would have been like two equals. Like, they're both essentially equally big movie stars. But because Sofia Boutella is a less well-known actor and a younger actor, and she's the only one whose boobs you actually see in the sex scene, it does wind up feeling more exploitative than it would if it were two actors on par with each other. And I think that is one of the problems in the scene.
Yeah, I hope that she had a good experience making this movie. This is a big deal for her. I'd never heard of her before. I've never seen her since. She got to do a big, fun movie with big stars, but I didn't think that the script gave her her due respect. It seemed like she was there to be bad at her job and then walk around in her underwear a lot. And I think better choices could have been made. Also, not just because I think we need to treat Sofia Boutella better, but because I think the plot would be more dynamic if she had something to add to it. Like, she's thrown into the mix, so give her further information, give her additional skills, give her a secret to tell. Like, it's never interesting if you're like, also, what if somebody showed her boobs? Like, we just dealt with this in The Long Kiss Goodnight. Like, oh, neat, you saw her boobs.
In the contrast to that, I do think that Theron's body is used very respectfully. Like, the initial shot of her going into the bath, like, I just have a note that says, oh my God, that lady's shoulders. Like, she looks so strong and tough. Like, she gets to be Jason Bourne in these movies. And I think that part is really nice. And it is a shame that there is a tacked on lesbian subplot with a totally expendable character, because you do see Theron being nude, but it always feels much more respectful than the nudity that Boutella has to do. And because Theron was a producer on this as well, I would have liked to have seen that dynamic feel more equitable.
I think because we had just watched The Long Kiss Goodnight, I expected the same dynamic of The Long Kiss Goodnight to carry through in this movie, and it's just a very different situation.
I feel like that statement somehow implies that The Long Kiss Goodnight was not the most bananas thing I've ever seen in my life. Like, this movie is a lot more straight than that one is, but I kind of take the point.
Oh, no. I recognize that The Long Kiss Goodnight is one of the biggest, dumbest things ever to happen in cinema, but I think the difference is that The Long Kiss Goodnight does not take anything it's doing seriously. It is all on its face, openly dumb, and I don't think this movie, even when it has moments of humor, ever embraces how dumb it could be.
I agree, but the reason that movie was camp and the reason it was funny is that it played a lot of its scenes very serious. Like, that movie was attempting to be a tearjerker in like about a 15-minute window. And this movie is similar in the sense that it thinks it's a fun, sexy, cool spy thriller. And it is mostly a set of very good action set pieces and a little bit of weird sex and some hot outfits. But I agree that there is more there in some ways in A Long Kiss Goodnight, but I wouldn't go too far out of your skis.
Listen, all I'm going to say is that The Long Kiss Goodnight is one of the best films ever made, and we can move on.
I do not agree. I didn't. All right, let's not relitigate The Long Kiss Goodbye, but let's do keep it moving here in East Berlin. To your point that there is a lot put into the aesthetic rather than into the story, though again, there is so much story. I think that the set design for the movie is really quite beautiful and unique. Like, they do a good job of situating the people, although Delphine and Lorraine's apartments look exactly the same. They both have like the exact same lighting, but I love Percival's apartment. It looks extremely lived in. I can't imagine what it was like to take that place down, though from the movie's perspective, no one has to because he burns the entire building apparently without wondering if anyone else is inside, but that's neither here nor there.
The set design, I'm of two minds about it, because on the one hand, everything is very beautiful. But on the other hand, like you said, things like Lorraine and Delphine's apartments looking identical sort of happens a lot. Like, whenever we're in a brutalist German building, it could be any building. Whenever we're in a brightly lit bar or apartment or whatever, it could be any place. Like, there's kind of only two modes, and that makes everything kind of blurred together. The watch shop is the same as the bar they all meet in.
Yeah, I think that's right. The initial scene where Charlize is climbing in and out of the bath, that place just looks like it's straight out of 2017. Like, there's nothing 80s about her apartment in Britain at all. But I do think they do a nice job of making Berlin feel like a place. But you're also not wrong that when they're in places like a bar, it doesn't necessarily feel like 1989. It feels like us looking back at 1989, which actually makes me think about our episode on 13 going on 30, because you made the point that they almost never want to do the makeup from the actual 80s because people won't recognize it. And I feel like maybe there was a piece of that here too, where they wanted to like signal the 80s while still keeping an aesthetic that looked recognizable to 2017.
Yeah, like a great example is her outfit when she gets off the plane. Her cover story is a lawyer. She is a 1989 lawyer in Europe, but she is wearing pants that connect to a bustier and red high heels and a very modern hairdo. And none of it reads lawyer. None of it reads 1989. It's all just a creation of how can we make Charlize Theron look fabulous? And she does, but that's why they have to lean so hard on the soundtrack and the cultural references to Sinead O'Connor and the Reagan clips. It's because if we weren't told every 10 seconds what year it is, you wouldn't get it.
Yeah, this movie is about 55% soundtrack and 45% fight scenes. And again, I don't have any notes. This is a movie that we turn on late at night, usually after we've already watched another movie, which is probably why I forgot how much movie there was after Spyglass gets killed, because I'm usually asleep for that part.
Oh, yeah. My last two notes are, oh, it's not done. And then this should not still be going on. We've done a lot of style talk. We haven't done a lot of talk about the plot itself. Should we go into the plot?
So Gascoigne is a British spy who's killed at the very beginning of the film. One of my favorite things about this movie is that the list that she's there to retrieve is codenamed The List. It's one of the best things in the movie, and I wish, like you, that they had leaned a little bit more into finding this fun, because it's almost there, right? Like, the very beginning of the movie is like talking about the Berlin Wall coming down, and they're like, this is not that movie. It's a different movie. So they should have just had more fun with it. You're not wrong. So probably one of the funnest scenes, I think, in the film is Lorraine landing in Germany and immediately being picked up by the KGB and immediately having a totally bananas fight scene. So what did you think about some of the action set pieces that really anchor this film?
I did think it was fun that they worked really hard, especially as the film went on, to make it look like most things were done in one take. There's a lot of editing to hide cuts as opposed to highlight them. There's a real sense of momentum and also loss of momentum. The fight scenes, as they drag on, everyone gets tired, everyone gets beat up, everyone gets out of breath and bloodied and limping. So that feels different than a movie that's just like punch, 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 and then we move on. Like, I don't know if I always loved it, but it was interesting.
There is a real way in which this movie takes Charlize Theron at the beginning and she's doing fine and then just like keeps beating her up, like so that by the end she can like barely get up to stand. And now hearing your reaction, I can only imagine that you are Charlize Theron, like slowly being ground down through the time that you've spent with her in Berlin.
I mean, I thank you for comparing me to Charlize Theron, because that's the greatest compliment I've ever received. She's luminous and brilliant, and I just do not compare. She's carrying not just the movie, but the action sequences, because they're almost always centered specifically on her. There's often, you know, six or seven randoms like running at her from different angles. And it's all just like, how does Charlize Theron deal with this?
These are fun action sequences to me. Like, she's always using unusual implements like her red shoe or that garden hose, turning up the music so that people can hear her. So the ultraviolence is done in a good way. And the editing is pretty phenomenal. They do a really good job of hiding, like you pointed out, a lot of the cuts so that you don't see Charlize going in and out between her and her stunt double. I think what this movie gets bogged down by is actually its story, which is so complicated.
Yeah, the other problem is that so much of the supposed intrigue is, who is Satchel? But I was pretty clear from the get that we were going to reveal that Charlize Theron is Satchel. Like, that wasn't a super secret.
I think the movie does an okay job of making you think for a little while that maybe James McAvoy is Satchel, and that that's what Delphine has on him.
I think they're trying for that. Maybe I've just watched too many movies, but there's something about the setup of her showing up to a big interview and weaving this big complicated tale. She's obviously Satchel, and everything she's doing is to cover her tracks. And this becomes more clear as, like, for instance, when James McAvoy gets the list, the first thing he does is look up who Satchel is. And sure, maybe he's just double checking that they know that he's Satchel. But the much more likely explanation is that he's not Satchel and he's trying to figure out who Satchel is. And that's Charlize Theron.
Yeah, because it's definitely not Delphine.
Oh, Jesus Christ. No.
Oh, bless. Imagine if it were her.
I mean, I did have like a vague moment where I was like, is she just playing being bad at this? But I'm like, no, none of her fuck ups help anybody. She's not laying a careful plan. She's actually just screwing up every step of the way. But the other issue is that because Charlize Theron is Satchel and is the one telling this story, we have a lot of unreliable narrator issues.
I know, I really gotta stop assigning these movies.
Well, the biggest problem comes when they are trying to sneak Spyglass over the border. Because James McAvoy shoots Spyglass, but Charlize Theron does not catch him doing it. And James McAvoy doesn't tell anyone that he did it. So how is that part of the story?
But we also get James McAvoy burning his apartment. We also spend time with him figuring out who Satchel is. If the movie is trying to pretend like Lorraine is the sole narrator of the story, I don't think that it makes it. And part of that is because it allows James McAvoy to talk to camera directly and break the fourth wall at least twice. And it's so unclear to me why he does that.
Yeah, I hated that. There are few things about this movie that I actually strongly disliked. Most of them were benign. But when I made eye contact with James McAvoy, I was out.
Oh, I was in.
Oh, he's beautiful, but he can't talk to me on my TV.
There's a couple of other fourth wall breaks that are a little weird. And I think they were trying to be sort of cute and do film stuff because they had done so much like good editing work that they decided to also bring in breaking the fourth wall. And I don't know what the benefit of that was.
There's two kind of really early moments where she talks about the film burning and it does, and then the skateboard thing happens. And so it kind of sets up that this is going to be a thing that happens a lot, but then there's like a solid hour before we get to James McAvoy talking to camera again.
Yeah, this feels like a movie that failed to make some choices. It needed to lean into some of the characters are aware of us as an audience. Like that would actually kind of make sense for Percival because he can't talk to MI6, right? So it would make sense for him to be talking to camera and giving us information that Lorraine can't have. They also, in terms of editing, do some kind of insane work in the car when she's driving with Spyglass. You can see the camera working kind of hard to get it done. There's a lot of like filmmaking for filmmaking's sake in this movie.
And again, the issue then becomes that the style ends up impeding the plot of these being incredibly good spies. Like, there's no world in which one of the smartest spies we've ever met actually just pulls over and stops with the person she's trying to protect without just double checking that she's not right at a crossroads where a car could plow into her. Like there's, or even stops at all. Just like, keep driving for the border, bitch.
And I think where they ran into problems is they wanted to make a fun action movie and they chose a property and it could be fun, but instead they like clung too hard to the double, triple crosses that were present in the original story. And what they should have done is just streamlined down a lot of the plot so that you could have fun.
Yeah, thinking about this plot doesn't help it. It doesn't withstand even a moment of scrutiny. Even basic things like in the scene where Charlize Theron, she has a really extended fight scene where she has to fight like 10 different people. She has Spyglass with a gunshot in his side and she looks at him and she's like, stay here. If there's, I don't know, 6 or 7 Russian agents in this building who want him dead, is just sit here and wait a good plan?
It's there to have a fun fight sequence where everybody falls down the stairs, and it's very good.
The fight sequence itself is pretty enjoyable if that's your cup of tea. Again, I'm 50-50 on a fight sequence in general, and since she's not in a fun outfit this time, there were diminishing returns for me.
She is in a lot of fun outfits for the various scenes. There's a really weird moment in this movie where she is in the interrogation describing the fact that she's like, and if I had known Percival was going to call the police, I would have worn a different outfit. And they have Toby Jones say a different outfit. And then John Goodman like looks over at him and like does something with his eyebrows. And it felt really like I was supposed to take some information away from that. And I couldn't take any, but I did like the John Goodman eyebrows.
I mean, okay, so two things responding to that. One, I was with you that I thought that the outfit would have significance to that scene, and it absolutely did not. And the thing is, like, it's a funny line. And if they had just let her say it and then moved on, then it would have just been, she's a sassy spy, and we could have left it. But the fact that both men on the other side of the table commented made it suddenly like, what's it gonna mean? And the answer is nothing.
I'm afraid that that might be the summation of this movie. It's like, what does it all mean? It doesn't mean anything. I think that must also be the scene where she pulls the turtleneck up over her nose. And it looks good. Whoever styled this movie is very good. You're right, it's not super 1989. Damn, if everybody doesn't look great. Delphine should really have a perm.
Because there are people like in the background who have just like a big teased hairsprayed bang. Like there's a couple placeholder 80s people on the fringes. But yeah, why does no one as a lead in this movie look like they're in the world that they have been placed in?
Because that wouldn't be as fun.
I disagree. I think Charlize Theron with an 80s haircut would look great. Why does she not have an eyelash to eyebrow blue eyeshadow? There's no reason not to do it.
Especially because there wouldn't have been any rules. Because as I mentioned at the top of the episode, I don't know what the styles were like in 1989. So have the best time possible. Like, why limit yourself to what would look hot on Charlize in 2017?
It was a missed opportunity through and through. To go back just a little bit, we talked about the eyebrow waggle. I just want to put out there that it is always welcome to have John Goodman in your film.
I know. That's why I didn't tell you he was here. I was hoping it would be like a little bit of catnip for you, but unfortunately it doesn't seem to have taken.
Oh, it was a wonderful surprise to see him pop up. I don't want to say he was wasted because it was like a visit from an old friend, but he didn't get to do anything.
I think that's because the character probably doesn't exist in the graphic novel, because also another deviation from the graphic novel, she's not an American spy in it. She's just actually a Russian spy. They just couldn't leave well enough alone and needed to make her also a good guy at the end so that they could spin it off into Atomic Blonde 2, which they are currently making.
Yeah, this movie had a real clear end at the end of her interview.
Yeah, it was her smoking that cigarette and us just all knowing that she was Satchel. And then somehow it went on for like another 15 minutes.
It was a huge letdown. I was so ready for it to be done. So everything that comes after that moment, even when it's well done, ends up failing because we can all feel how desperately tacked on it is.
I think a much more interesting movie is knowing that she's Satchel at the end of the movie, and then you build a second movie off, explore more about like Lorraine and why she's made these choices, and do a whole movie where she's a Russian agent, and then you could do a reveal at the end of that movie that she's actually an American agent, and then do a third movie about how she's actually been working for the CIA this whole time.
And as you point out, revealing that she's supposed to be a Russian agent at the end of this movie doesn't make sense to the whole previous plot where the Russians are constantly trying to kill her.
Speaking of things that I don't know how they work, how was Percival listening to her? Because I know that he's put a bug in her coat. I get that. How is he receiving that tape? Is it through a transmitter of some kind? And is he just following her all the time because he's got her in bed? He's got her all kinds of places. I don't understand without the internet how Percival is obtaining what Lorraine is saying.
I mean, I guess some sort of radio transmission. But also, is she always wearing that coat?
Oh, a really good point. He's got audio of her at the bar with Delphine, but she very dramatically gives her coat to the coat check so that we can reveal the gorgeous backless dress she's wearing.
Yeah, it's not as though she's always in a heavy coat. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, this is another one I wish we hadn't thought about.
Oh, if ever there was a film that didn't withstand scrutiny, it's this motherfucker right here.
I don't know. Death Becomes Her was pretty rough. For me, personally.
I think it's because this film thinks that it has a carefully constructed plot. It pretends as though it is one domino knocking down the next, knocking down the next. It is, in fact, one domino falling flat on its face.
I am kept on my toes, but mostly because I'm just like, wait, what's happening? Like I said, I have seen this movie probably like, I don't know, 5 or 6 times. I should know at this point what the twists and turns are. And I was still like, huh? All right. So then why is he helping get Spyglass's family across the border? You're just shaking your head. This is an audio format once again.
That protest scene is one of the most challenging in this film because both James McAvoy and Charlize Theron are talking about the parts of the plan that they know and don't know, and each of them has set up pieces of the puzzle that the other is unaware of, but none of it is coherent. Like, we're supposed to see this as like double and triple crossing, but it's just people running around being ridiculous.
I think the reason why that scene falls down is that the audience doesn't understand why Percival would be helping this family. And I understand that Percival wants Spyglass to die so that there's not a second copy of the list and so that he has the only copy of the list. It just seems like he has set up a ridiculous Rube Goldberg machine in order to kill Spyglass when we know he has access to the East and he could just hire somebody to kill him, hire the Russians to kill him, or just, like, make it happen on his own.
And notably, because Charlize Theron is Satchel, she should want Spyglass dead. When her car goes into the river with Spyglass in it, what a great out. Don't try and pull him out. Let the motherfucker drown.
Yeah, I don't know what her plan is. It's like she's just a good person, so she's trying to save him. She doesn't really have a ton of interior monologue or a ton of ability to show us, the audience, like what her ultimate goal is. Like at the very end of the movie, she's like, I just want my life back. And I was like, oh, I didn't know that's what your plan was. Wait, what of your life got stolen?
We're shown her feeling remorse that Gascoigne and Delphine got killed. And so I guess there's an implication that she wants an emotional connection with someone. And when she forms emotional connections with them, or at least sexual connections that we are meant to interpret as emotional, those people die. So maybe there's something there, but none of that is explored. It's just she fucks someone, they die, there's one close-up of a teary eye, and then we move on.
I think the movie tries to throw at us that Lorraine may actually feel something for Delphine, perhaps in a way that she did not for James, because she seems actually upset that Delphine has died, but she has also put Delphine in wild amounts of danger and doesn't seem to like take any steps to actively get her out of the city. She's just like, you should go. Oh, I guess I feel guilty about it. Let me come buzz your door a whole bunch of times while James McAvoy is murdering you. God, that scene goes on forever with the murder, doesn't it? Oof.
Yeah, we see so many scenes of Charlize Theron always being able to think ahead about the fights that she's in, and Delphine is scrambling. She gets a couple good hits in, but we just have to watch her die at length because she can't defend herself because she's just a thin, beautiful woman in her underwear, and it feels exploitative.
At the point at which my lover told me I needed to get the fuck out of Berlin, I probably wouldn't be having my headphones in while I, like, just move about the apartment in my lingerie. But I'm a practical girl.
The headphones are one of 1,000 examples of people who are supposedly the best trained spies in the world doing some of the dumbest shit I've ever seen. Charlize Theron has a drink handed to her, and she just drinks it. There is no world where I accept a drink from a stranger and just chug it in front of them. And I'm not a spy. I just know that people put things in drinks.
Especially because very late in the film, she pours a drink for Brimovich and he makes her drink it first. For exactly that reason.
I mean, side note, everyone in this film has 3 shots of vodka in them at all times.
Oh yeah, big time. In fact, do you know what the inspiration for me choosing this movie was specifically from The Last Kiss Goodnight?
Was it the scene where Gina Davis takes the best shot of all time?
No, though that was one of the hottest things I've ever seen in my entire life. It is actually the fact that as soon as she dyes her hair blonde, she pours herself a vodka. And I was like, all right, I guess we're watching Atomic Blonde.
I did see the parallels to several key Gina Davis moments. So, like, I saw where you were going. I wonder if I would have liked this a little better if it hadn't been directly paralleled with A Long Kiss Goodnight.
Oh, interesting.
I kind of don't think so. I kind of think that this is just not for me. But I wonder if there was like a hint of me wanting there to be a campier sensibility than there was. We'll never know.
I guess we won't. We can't go back in time. Unlike that one episode that we decided not to record. Friends, you'll never know what it is because we'll never discuss it again. I'm sure we will.
I was going to say, we're going to run out of movies eventually. I can think of several circumstances in which we would talk about exactly that episode.
Well, we tweeted it. Look back through the Twitter feed, see if you can figure it out.
So I want to be clear that I think it's not that this is a bad movie, but I think that the script and the source material that they have is a mismatch to the director and the styling. So it's essentially 2 things that shouldn't go together going together, and I would have liked either property separately, perhaps.
I do think there is a really interesting story here, and I would love to watch Charlize and James McAvoy tell it. It's just that, like, when you stop and think about the component pieces of this movie, it doesn't super work.
I love a cerebral mystery in a film. And I think some of my issue is that I was continually promised that. And this is just never as smart as it wants to be.
It's not a smart movie and it's not a dumb movie.
That's it. That's the pull quote, everyone. We've summed it up.
Great. All right. Well, anything else that you want to add about Atomic Blonde before we wrap up?
I think everyone involved did their absolute best, and I just won't ever watch this film again.
I will watch this movie a million more times whenever I want to watch Charlize beat a whole bunch of random Stasi assholes up, and when I want to watch James McAvoy be very charming, which he is in extremely every film. I feel like James McAvoy might have gotten short shrift here. I know we talked about him a little bit, but like, he's really good, you guys. You should watch pretty much anything that he's in. He always improves the material. Like, I see you blinking.
Oh, no, I would encourage everyone in the audience to watch a different James McAvoy movie.
How dare you? I've never seen Wanted, but there's a real strong chance that we're watching it for this podcast.
I think I've seen that. Is that his Angelina Jolie one?
Yeah. I want to watch him and a different hot lady like flip over in a car. That's pretty much all I want from an action movie.
Weirdly, I saw that in the theater, and my recollection is that it is very similar to this movie in that it is action sequences strung together by a complex plot that doesn't make a lick of sense.
Coming up next week. No, I'm just kidding. All right, so let's wrap this one up. How can I put this? I agree with everything you said, and I agree that the movie has failings. I don't think it will diminish my enjoyment of this movie one lick. So with all that being said, we're not going to do the long version of this. We're a podcast. Please rate and subscribe. We're on the social medias. You can find us there. Chris, what are we going to watch next week?
So I agonized over this because so many of my movies are the exact same late 80s, early 90s silly comedy with one very loud female character.
Sometimes several.
Sometimes more than one. That's the only differentiating feature is how many loud women are in the movie. So I decided to go for something that kind of defies genre altogether. We will be watching the 1982 Jim Henson film, The Dark Crystal.
Okay. I have seen The Dark Crystal before as an adult. I did not watch it or actually Labyrinth as a child because I was convinced that they would both be too scary for me. So that is the Frady Cat bar for anybody who wonders why we don't do horror movies on this podcast. My memory is that it is sort of like a darker, the never-ending story. I remember some of the characters. I have to say, I don't know that I'm excited to watch this movie again, but I am going to watch this movie again because that is the premise of the show.
It's interesting to think of The Dark Crystal as scary because I guess it is, but it's also deeply not. I know that you are scared by different things than me, but I think as an adult, you will look at this and be interested in the idea that this film could ever scare someone.
I also have absolutely nothing to stand on because knowing that you aren't a big fan of blood, I assigned you this movie, which is just Charlize Theron putting people's brains all over walls and her being beaten within an inch of her life. This movie was so much more violent than I remembered it being, so I do apologize for that. I did text you about it, but it was not enough of a warning. So whatever level of terror I feel, I'm not actually afraid of The Dark Crystal. I just don't like the Skeksis. So we'll deal with that next week.
All right. I hope that you and anyone listening isn't horrified by this film. But if you are, I do apologize. We'll see you next week and talk it out.
We'll talk it through then. Bye, everybody.
I've never muted one of my coughs for you, so don't feel like obliged.